Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel within the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the hosts of this channel. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. James Stafford, teaches at Columbia University and specializes in the political and intellectual history of Ireland, Britain and Western Europe since 1750, with a particular interest in questions of political economy and international order. And very much in that vein, he has just published a book entitled The Case of Ireland, Commerce, Empire, and the European Order, 1750 to 1848, which touches on all of these big intellectual concerns of his. Welcome, Professor Stafford. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I might jump in straight away and ask, what exactly is The Case of Ireland? Because it's obviously the title of your book, and yet it's also a kind of trope that runs through the book itself.
Yeah, sure. So the case of Ireland is, you know, the phrase I've taken from a very well-known late 17th century pamphlet by a Anglo-Irish Anglican philosopher and lawyer, William Molyneux, who wrote a pamphlet in 1698, arguing against the legislative supremacy of the English Parliament at Westminster over what was then a separate Irish Parliament at Dublin as part of the Irish Kingdom of the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries. What I do in the book, and this kind of follows the moves of subsequent Anglo-Irish patriots and then subsequently Irish nationalist writers in the 19th century in invoking this phrase, the case of Ireland, is look at how different groups seeking different kinds of Irish autonomy, not just independence and separation, but also autonomy within the British Empire, make that argument in the context of the international politics of 18th and 19th century Europe. So that's one thread, the case of Ireland, in that legal sense that that Molyneux meant it, making an argument for Ireland. But that intersects with another spin on the phrase, which is more my own, about the idea of Ireland acting as a kind of case study in European discussions of two things, really, of the ways in which foreign trade and colonial trade could be a source of political power in 18th and 19th century Europe, and about the British Empire as the prime, most successful, most dangerous exponent, that kind of power in the world, but also as a case study in different models of, you know, what we could now call capitalist development, what at the time might be called something like the progress of commerce or the progress of opulence or commercial society, and how Ireland's particular social structure, being the product of conquest and settlement in the 17th century, could reveal or support different positions in arguments about the nature of commercial society and its institutional and legal organization. That's particularly important after the French Revolution, which is interpreted across Europe, including in Ireland, as a revolution against aristocracy, but particularly against the concentrated ownership of landed property. So there's one dimension, the case of Ireland, about Irish independence and autonomy, but there's another dimension, which is the case of Ireland as an example for how empire and aristocracy operate in 18th and 19th century politics.
So one of the things I did find quite interesting is that issue of how this is not really a history of Ireland itself. It's more about the idea of Ireland and how that's being used and deployed by different thinkers for different reasons. Can you say a little bit more about how Ireland becomes a kind of shorthand for debates about empire within the European Enlightenment?
Sure, yeah. I mean, so it really starts, I think at least, with Montesquieu, the French jurist and kind of comparative legal theorist and historian, kind of really central figure of the French and European Enlightenment, noticing the case of Ireland in his book, 1748 book, The Spirit of the Laws. And he makes quite a specific argument there, not about Ireland as a shorthand for empire in general, but Ireland as a shorthand for one model of empire, commercial empire. And what Montesquieu says in The Spirit of the Laws, in the middle of his discussion of England as a commercial power, is that when a commercial people with a parliamentary government conquer, they're more brutal, more exclusionary to their provinces than a monarchy would be. He uses Ireland, which he says has a good civil constitution because modeled on the English constitution, but its external autonomy is, as he puts it, crushed by the right of nations. So the English have conquered Ireland and subordinated it commercially. And this is a kind of pattern of commercial empire that sees, as one of Montesquieu's most important readers, the Scottish philosopher David Hume, that sees even a territory settled with Anglo-Irish colonists, with people who are notionally of the same religion and the same national or ethnic identity as the mother country, sees even them being subordinated to England's ruthless commercial reason of state. So this, in a sense, is an adoption of the Molyneux argument in the case of Ireland, which is a sort of a kind of Anglo-Irish special pleading, right, as a kind of, hey, we are the people who subordinated this territory for you. And now we just want to, you know, practice proto-industry and export wool and, you know, exploit our tenantry how we want to. And you're not letting us because of these commercial restrictions that restrict our liberty to participate in the fruits of empire with you. That's essentially the Molyneux argument. And this is what Montesquieu and then David Hume notice, that there's something particularly exclusionary about a kind of empire that treats even its own settler colonists as badly as England treats the Anglo-Irish. So that's the kind of argument that gets invoked about Ireland in the 18th century. And Montesquieu is making that argument as part of the way in which he's kind of sizing up England and British commercial power in The Spirit of the Laws. It's obviously a text written initially for a French audience, although it assumed a European significance. And Hume is writing in this capacity as a disinterested Scottish critic of English commercial reason of state, seeking to reform English commercial policy. And then that's a trope that other early advocates of union with Ireland, like the Welsh cleric and political economist Josiah Tucker, then take up to say that, look, it's counterproductive to treat your own people, your own colonists, as badly as English commercial policy treats Ireland. And then that trope circulates to America in the colonial crisis of the 1760s and 1770s, and then kind of finds its way back into Irish, Anglo-Irish criticisms of British commercial policy during the time of the American crisis. So it has quite a long and quite a transatlantic career, this idea that there's something uniquely brutal about British commercial empire.
So I think, it's interesting that this has longevity, and yet also there's a very interesting scope that you're engaging here of moving from Ireland at one level to the broader British and British imperial world, to Europe, to the end of the, to the Atlantic world, and how it's operating at these different levels. At one point, you do talk about how certain figures within the United Irishmen, particularly more radical figures, are engaging in this critique also of colonialism and of British colonial context, but focusing specifically on the Atlantic slave trade. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. And you know, here obviously, this is a part of the book that draws, you know, quite heavily on earlier work, particularly by Nene Rogers. But there are kind of two moments in the book where the question of the Atlantic slave trade becomes central. And the first of those is in the 1780s, actually, before the emergence of the United Irishmen following the French Revolution, where one of the reasons that the possibility of a kind of Irish commercial independence within the British Empire is so threatening to British policymakers is that it raises the specter of Ireland importing and then re-exporting sugar from Caribbean colonies that are not controlled by Britain at a time where Saint-Domingue in particular, but also Spanish and Dutch colonies are becoming more productive and producing cheaper sugar than British colonies. So there's a threat to British control of the transatlantic sugar trade into England, represented by the idea that that once, following this so-called constitutional revolution of 1782, when Britain relinquished the right to legislate, control Irish trade, that the Irish kingdom would use that commercial autonomy to undermine Britain's transatlantic empire of slaves and sugar. Now, in that context, it's not actually Irish advocates of commercial independence who are making the case against the slave trade in those terms. It's a problem that's noticed by Josiah Tucker, again, this figure I mentioned earlier, this Welsh cleric who is a kind of Anglican, early Anglican abolitionist, albeit, you know, even more gradualist than later abolitionists were. He's a figure that my colleague Chris Brown writes quite a lot about in his book Moral Capital. And Tucker's argument is that competition with free-grown sugar imported via Ireland will eventually produce the unraveling of the British colonial system in the Caribbean, which is already being buffeted by the loss of commercial control of the North American colonies, and that Ireland can then act as a kind of agent of a commercial providentialism, if you like, that will bring about the unraveling of the British sugar colony. Mm-hmm. So that's a more passive and commercial version, but it's in a way a kind of inversion of that earlier trope of Ireland as a an example of the excesses of commercial empire that maybe Ireland can be turned into an agency of reform of British commercial empire. That's Tucker's hope in the 1780s. Now, following the French Revolution, the stakes in the slavery issue were obviously raised by the Haitian Revolution and the French Republic's kind of forced endorsement of its results as part of its struggle to hang on to control of its colonies in the Caribbean against British and Spanish invasion. But this obviously gives a once the French Republic has become for this kind of period of the mid to late 1790s, a notionally anti-slavery power that obviously gives a powerful new argument, particularly in these sort of Presbyterian circles in Northern Ireland and around Belfast, where there, as Nini Rogers has written about, where there's quite a deep culture of anti-slavery activism by the 1790s. It gives them a powerful new argument against continued participation in the British Empire and in the war against France, which at that point can fairly legitimately be styled as a war to uphold slavery. So the argument that Thomas Russell in particular, and Russell is a close collaborator of Wolfe Tone, one of the driving forces behind the Northern Star newspaper, famous United Irish newspaper centered on Belfast, makes is about the participation of Irish workers and soldiers and consumers in a slaving economy by virtue of paying taxes to the British state to pursue its war in defense of slavery in the Caribbean. And in the book, you know, I draw quite a strong contrast between the kind of different flavors of, you know, one of the, obviously the literature on the United Irishman is tremendously rich, but the sort of distinct contribution I try to make is sort of teasing out the different threads in United Irish thinking about commerce and international order. So I kind of contrast Thomas Russell with Wolfe Tone and with a third figure, Arthur O'Connor, who's a kind of latecomer to the movement, but a real enthusiast for kind of the political economy of Adam Smith and also for French revolutionary thinkers like Sieyès and Condorcet. And where Wolfe Tone has a kind of radicalized patriot, what we might think of as a sort of economic nationalist vision of Irish grandeur as being the goal of revolution. And Arthur O'Connor is kind of very focused on the question of land and aristocracy and how to use a French invasion to revolutionize the Irish social hierarchy. It's Russell who has this this universalist and this ethical conception of what resistance to Britain and Ireland might entail. So I think that's really his sort of distinctive contribution at that point.
So as I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast will know, the United Irishman Rebellion does not bring about that kind of grandeur or any kind of autonomy, really. It brings out the exact opposite of that with the Act of Union. And I think it's fascinating that you look at that as a kind of a European event rather than just this insular Irish or Irish-British event. What does it mean to see the Act of Union in these kind of in this kind of broader European framework?
Sure. Well, I'll actually, I mean, I'll start, if I may, with the first part of the question about sort of 1798 and the response to that. Because I think kind of going back to Molyneux, it's important to understand that in these juridical terms, union for a lot of Irish thinkers in the 18th century was preferable to the alternative of being a separate kingdom but being explicitly subordinate to Westminster. And there's a lot of rhetorical investment in both British and Irish champions of union in the pamphlet debate, very extensive pamphlet debate, which I go into in the book, that actually the offer of union is a kind of recognition of Irish sovereignty, is a recognition that, as on the Scottish model, Ireland is not a subordinate colonial province, but a kingdom that can be treated with as an equal in the course of the negotiations for union. Now, you know, obviously, from all the work that's been done on, you know, Secret Service expenditure, on bribing members of the Dublin Parliament, and the broader context, the military context, obviously, of a rebellion having been put down and Crown troops being on the ground in quite some numbers in Ireland after 1798, make that, you know, difficult to maintain as a kind of full historical account of what was going on in the Union. But it was quite an important point for those who supported it, that it was a kind of, that it wasn't going back to the pre-1782 situation, that it was taking Irish legislative independence seriously, because Ireland, through its parliament, had to consent to union, even if that consent was forced. And, you know, turning to the European context, that's one of the ways in which critics of union interpreted it, because they drew a parallel with the French revolutionary practice of réunion, but, you know, maybe the best example is the incorporation of what's now Belgium into metropolitan France in 1794 through a referendum, but a referendum watched over by French troops. So there is a kind of emerging norm of kind of annexation by consent in Europe in the 1790s, and there are critics of union, kind of weak critics of union, like Richard Sheridan, the playwright, but also very prolific and active spokesman for Irish interests in the Westminster Parliament, who draws this direct comparison between the French incorporation of neighbouring states through conquest and then referendums that create an illusion of consent and the British Union with Ireland. But beyond that kind of point about the legitimacy of union and how it relates to kind of changing European justifications for conquest and annexation, there's also the point which both the British, but also Irish and continental European kind of defenders or proponents of British power sought to make with the Union. So its meaning in a European context in 1800 is another thing that the book is concerned with, that the chapters about the Union are mm-hmm. concerned with. And here it's really goes back to what we were saying earlier about Ireland as a symbol of Britain's kind of ruthless commercial policy, that union is styled by its defenders in Britain and Ireland, but also in continental Europe. And I go into some detail about this Prussian publicist and later diplomat, quite a significant figure in the Congress of Vienna and the German formats, Friedrich Gentz, who writes about union as showing, in essence, that British commercial empire has matured and is capable of representing a common European interest, because the Irish kingdom, which had been placed in a subordinate position throughout the 18th century, that had been denied access to the spoils of empire elsewhere in the world, was now in a gesture of British magnanimity being incorporated into the metropole. And he talks about the way in which through the Act of Union, all Britain's colonies also become Irish colonies. Mm-hmm. And then this is related to a separate argument, which is about the complementarity of British commercial wealth with European commercial progress. And this is taken up in the era of the continental system, then in the early decades, and in the first decade of the Union, which was also a really intense decade of commercial and military confrontation, global commercial and military confrontation between the British Empire and Napoleon's empire in continental Europe, the era of the continental system, Napoleon's attempt to blockade, to cut off Britain from trade with the European continent, also the British Orders in Council, which are about restricting the trade of neutrals with France. So in this era of kind of commercial warfare between the British and French empires, Ireland is used as an example of the benefits of trade with Britain. Because this is a period of very high prices for Irish food, for Irish grain exports. A lot of these arguments which draw on customs house sort of trade figures, these look notionally very good for Ireland in the first decade of the Union. So the argument is made by François Divenoir, who's an interesting figure in the book, an exile from Geneva, who becomes a subject, a British subject, by becoming an Irish subject when he's part of the Genevan colony at Waterford in the 1780s, who then ends up being a kind of diplomat, another figure like Friedrich Gentz, a sort of diplomat publicist in British pay, who uses the case of Ireland to make the case to European countries that they should abandon Napoleon's continental system and return to trade with Britain, and that Britain is not an exploitative monopolist, but instead that its progress can lift all boats in Europe, and that it's not a zero-sum competition between European commercial and economic interests and British commercial and economic interests.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So as you then trace this into the 19th century, how much do these thinkers or thinkers like these continue to sort of use Ireland or think about Ireland, whether looking at Daniel O'Connell or at the rise of the Young Ireland movement and things like this? Ireland obviously doesn't stay peaceful under the Union. It stays fairly turbulent throughout probably all of the 19th century, really.
Yes, exactly. And this is, one of the ways, going back to your earlier point about kind of images of Ireland, you know, the collapse of that Irish agrarian boom in the later 1810s, the emergence of Rockism and then O'Connellism in the 1820s is really a kind of watershed moment for European perceptions of Ireland. And what the last chapter of the book really outlines is a debate within European liberalism about Ireland and what Ireland says about Britain and British power, because Britain has quite a sort of ambivalent significance, particularly for French liberals. And I talk quite a bit about Gustave de Beaumont, who is best known as the traveling companion of Alexis de Tocqueville, but was also a significant political thinker in his own right within a kind of Tocquevillian framework, which was also his framework. And you know, they have a great admiration for Britain and British institutions, but they're also aware that particularly this powerful role of aristocracy and aristocratic landholding, concentrated landholding, large estates held together by laws of primogeniture, so inheritance of the eldest son, and entail, so restrictions on the sale or alienation of land over generations, that these are institutions that were destroyed in the French Revolution, which they do not wish to see restored because they see them as incompatible with a society that they describe as democratic, defined by developing equality, not necessarily material equality, but equality of status and equality before the law. And they're very concerned about efforts within France, particularly before the July Revolution of 1830, to restore that pre-revolutionary social order, which they see as doomed, however much as in the case of Tocqueville, as a kind of ambivalence or a kind of emotional attachment to some of the things that aristocracy can bring. So when they're thinking about this problematic of aristocracy and democracy and landed property, Gustave de Beaumont looked to Britain and saw a state that had this curious mixture of rapid industrialization and urban growth, as was the case by the 1820s, 1830s, but also an aristocratic structure of landholding, but also of political representation, even after the 1832 Reform Act. And the role that Ireland then played for Gustave de Beaumont within that framework was essentially that the Union had placed at the heart of the British state and the British constitution a really flawed and unstable version of that aristocratic social order, because it was an aristocratic social order which, as de Beaumont called it, was semi-feudal and semi-colonial, that it didn't command the same natural legitimacy that the English aristocracy could enjoy, because it was based on a very recent and dubious history of conquest and expropriation in the 17th century. So de Beaumont saw Daniel O'Connell as the kind of herald, albeit, you know, and this is where the kind of the fact that you know, this is still a kind of imperial perspective in Ireland, that de Beaumont saw O'Connell as kind of as rough and perhaps not capable of sort of mature political leadership, but nonetheless was a kind of herald of democracy in Ireland, and that Ireland sort of was importing the germ of democracy into the British political system and was going to cause some kind of smash or breakdown at some point, because its conceptions of property and of the need for equality were fundamentally different to those entertained by Britain's anomalous aristocratic industrial social system. So in a sense, you know, that represents to me a kind of morphing of some of the kind of propaganda arguments of the French Revolutionary period into the terms of European liberalism and social science or even sociology in the early 19th century. And so, you know, relocates Ireland again. Mm-hmm.
I might end then with a somewhat self-serving question about all of this. The character of Edmund Burke kind of pops up a lot in your book. He's almost like a recurring character across all of this narrative. And I've, out of my own research interests, I found this very intriguing, because so much of what you're talking about, he's concerned about how to create a stable social order based on private property, how to maintain the British Empire and all of these kind of places, either in the Atlantic world or in France after the revolution, he is massively interested in. And yet, frustratingly, he never writes a sustained book about Ireland. So how does he, how do you feel that he fits into all this?
I think you can see he's someone who doesn't get any of what he wants in an Irish context, but nonetheless, I think exerted a profound influence over what happened. I mean, Burke sort of, he crops up in a number of places, but I don't really develop a line on him in the book. He's someone who is very skeptical of institutional fixes to the problem of Irish autonomy and Irish trade. He's critical of William Pitt the Younger, the British Prime Minister's sort of first scheme for a kind of Irish commercial treaty with Britain in 1785. Because he thinks that it's better for, as in the case of America, for Britain to have a kind of informal superiority over the Irish kingdom, that the facts of Irish dependency on Britain are enough and that they don't need to be rubbed in the face of the Irish Parliament by the British Parliament through things like a declaratory act or a commercial agreement that Burke and his allies in the opposition to Pitt the Younger see as very unequal. And obviously that vision of Irish autonomy kind of really falls with the Union of 1801. So his kind of Whig support for the continuance of an Irish kingdom as part of a generalised support for decentralised and varied systems of authority rather than centralising uniform government is definitely the part of his political belief system which is really not honoured by Ireland's rulers at the end of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. But the other and kind of more substantive commitment that he has in an Irish context to Catholic conciliation, to an Anglican confessional state through allowing Catholics to participate in political life is something that is a product of this period. And it's interesting, some of the, so obviously one of the, as many of our listeners will know, one of the really controversial things about the Union, other than the way in which it's passed in a context of force and fraud, is this promise, informal promise made to the Irish Catholic hierarchy by William Pitt and another British minister, Henry Dundas, that Catholic emancipation, as it was termed, so a right of Catholics to participate in the Westminster Parliament, was kind of part of the deal with Union, that indeed Union made it possible because it removed the threat of a Catholic majority within Ireland from Irish Protestants. And, you know, the entire, I mean, one of the really striking things about this Catholic debate of the Union, on the Union, is that the entire thing is conducted on the understanding that this is what's going to happen. So people making the argument for Union say, well, Union has to happen so that Catholics can be fully enfranchised. I mean, Catholics are enfranchised by this point, they're enfranchised in 1793, but that they also have the right to sit as members of Parliament. And also crucially, and this is a dimension which is often lost, but to hold municipal offices. So there's also a local political dimension to this. So this whole question of Catholic emancipation is one that Burke didn't address in public, but by 1795, 96, 97, was writing in support of privately, particularly to Irish followers like the Anglo-Irish MP, William Smith, who I talk about quite a bit in the chapter on Union, who makes an argument for union in these Burkean terms, that it enables a Catholic conciliation, and says that had Burke witnessed 1798, he would have come around to union as a solution to this problem. And this is what leads kind of the nascent sort of Orange unionist position, like the Orange Grand Master, Patrick Duigenan, to say that the union manifests a spirit of Burkism, is what he calls it. So there is, in that sense, a Burkean flavour to what happens in 1801, albeit then deferred until 1829, where Catholic emancipation is granted in terms which I think would have horrified Burke. It's exactly the same pattern that caused him to really turn on the volunteer movement and Anglo-Irish patriotism in 1778-9 of forcing a concession from the British government. And at that moment, at the end of the 1770s, he condemned the British government vociferously for allowing things to get to this point where they had to make a concession under threat of force because they had no alternative. But he's also condemns his sort of erstwhile political allies within Anglo-Irish patriotism for being willing to push their point so hard. So there's a lot of, so as you say, Burke kind of hovers over things, but there's a lot of ambivalence. I mean, just the final point, and this goes actually to a sort of different part of the universe of Burke scholarship. Donald Winch, a Sussex intellectual historian of political economy, talks about this issue of the Burke-Smith problem. And Burke's commitment to the defense, not just of property in general, but of large property, and specifically these laws of primogeniture and entail, which are the target of the entire spectrum of French revolutionary opinion, not just Jacobins, but Girondins as well. The destruction of which is kind of for early 19th century French liberals like de Beaumont, as I said, the most durable legacy of revolution. And what I think is really interesting is that Burke wins that argument within British political economy in the early 19th century. And it's because of, Smith is a proponent of partitive inheritance, of small scale farming, says a great proprietor, seldom a great improver. And that's on the basis of thinking that the division of labor in agriculture is very restricted. So that's a real tension between him and Burke, potentially. And the way that tension is resolved within British political economy is in favor of consolidated land ownership and large estates, because the argument made is that this actually can be more productive. And this is taken from kind of British agrarian thinkers like Arthur Young, who's the author of a famous tour in Ireland. Young's argument, so when Young actually went to Ireland, he didn't think that it was so irrational that Irish peasants lived on small plots and lived from potatoes. He thought it was a temporary phase that would pass, but that there was some rational justification for it. Whereas by the early 19th century, more kind of doctrinaire British political economists like James Ramsay McCulloch are saying, no, we know from Britain that large farms on consolidated estates with single owners is the way that we get kind of maximally efficient agrarian capitalism, and we need to impose this model on Ireland through estate clearances. Mm-hmm. So already foreshadowing a lot of then what happens with the famine and the emergence of strong farming mm-hmm. in Ireland in the middle of the 19th century. So in that sense, you see a defense of a core Burkean commitment of a strong aristocracy with big consolidated property being made in terms which are quite foreign to him, kind of drawn from more from agronomic thinking, from the sort of actually nuts and bolts, well, how much capital do you need to have a threshing machine? Kind of, this is the argument by the early 19th century. So in that sense, he's kind of vindicated within British political economy.
So what I think all of this shows is that the really complicated number of themes and questions and problems that you're combining here, from intellectual history to social, even social history and political history and the history of political economy. The case of Ireland, Commerce, Empire, and the European Order is out now with Cambridge University Press as part of their Ideas in Context series. Thanks so much, James, for this great conversation.
Thank you so much.